Good afternoon. My name is Ashley Teasdale, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the University of Maine and Dickinson College, it is my pleasure to welcome you to this afternoon's address, Why Public Service? Speaking this afternoon will be James B. Comey, Senior Vice President and General Counsel at Lockheed Martin Corporation. Mr. Comey served as Deputy Attorney General of the United States from 2003 to 2005, when he joined Lockheed Martin as a Senior Vice President and General Counsel. As Deputy Attorney General, he oversaw many important and controversial cases, including terrorism and securities fraud prosecutions. Mr. Comey earned his BS with honors in chemistry and religion in 1982 from the College of William and Mary, and his JD in 1985 from the University of Chicago Law School. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and pagers. Also, please hold any questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because we are taping this event, and out of courtesy to those who are hearing impaired, please wait until a microphone is brought to you before speaking. And now, please join me in welcoming James B. Comey.
You're going to be a great lawyer. Yeah. Well, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you so much for inviting me here today to share some thoughts about public service, and then the best part for me is to take your questions. My topic today is why public service? And what I thought I would do to try to answer that question is offer some general thoughts about public service and then share with you a couple of reflections from my time in the government. College at William & Mary kindled in me a fire of sorts to do something in public service. I first thought that I wanted to be a doctor, and although I finished my chemistry major, some of my experiences in chemistry convinced me that maybe that was not the best place for me. And I decided maybe I would be better as a lawyer, could make a bigger contribution writing and speaking than I could thinking about formulas and equations. My girlfriend at the time, and now my wife and the mother of my five children, caught a similar bug in college and went into the Peace Corps in West Africa after we graduated, and then teaching public school in Chicago and elsewhere. And I went on to law school. As corny as it sounds, we each chose career paths that would give us the chance to do public service for the same reason. Each of us thought that it would be a neat thing to have a job with moral content, a job where your obligation every morning was to get up and do something good for your community or your country or your world. And we set about to do that and realized that public service can be very hard on your credit cards. Public service can be very hard when you're trying to balance other responsibilities in life, like raising children. It can be even harder when you look over at friends and colleagues, maybe folks you went to school with, who are making a lot more dough at jobs that are considered prestigious in whatever field you happen to be working in. At times like that, though, I think it's especially important for young people who think about public service to remember the advice that Albert Einstein gave young folks. He said this: try not to become a person of success, but rather try to become a person of value. If those friends of yours making all that dough never take a chance to build a school in a poor village or to change a young student's life by spending time with him or her when they're struggling with math or with English, or to protect the vulnerable from violent predators, I suppose they may have found success, but they've missed real value, which is a tragedy. As I said, as the father of five children, I know as well as anyone that the burdens of life and caring for those that you have responsibility for can make it hard to do public service. Many people, of course, because of those burdens, can't do it for an entire career, but I quietly ache for those who never even try it, even for a brief period of time, or those who don't stay with it because they hear that siren song of prestige from someplace else. During the time that I was United States Attorney in Manhattan, I hired 50 young men and women as assistant U.S. attorneys. Each of those 50 was walking away from huge dough, almost all of them at big law firms, walking away to come work like an absolute dog for me, 7 days a week, nearly all their waking hours, just as I had done when Rudy Giuliani hired me as an assistant U.S. attorney, and just as he had done when he was hired as an assistant U.S. attorney, and just as generations of men and women had done for almost 200 years in that place. A lot of people did it, as I did, in part to get great experience that would help them later in their careers. But every single one of the 50 I hired did it because they heard some version of this. Somebody who knew about that experience in public service said to them, "You got to try this. You will be amazed what it feels like to stand up and say, 'I represent the United States of America.' You've got to feel that." All 50 heard some version of that speech. And the reason I know that is I used to ask them, "What inspired you to come here?" When I was lucky enough to become the Deputy Attorney General, I traveled all over the country to talk to the people I called the troops, the folks I referred to as the real Department of Justice. The people who did the actual work in the Department of Justice were spread all over the country and all over the world. And as I would go to all of these duty stations and talk to the agents and the paralegals and the Bureau of Prisons people and the prosecutors, I would share with them five expectations that I had long had for people in public service, for people working in any great public institution. And I thought that I would share them with you very briefly. I hope to give you, especially the young people, some sense of what an amazing thing it is to work in a great public institution. The first thing I told them is, I expect that you will work hard. Now, that's going to be easy because you're going to be representing the United States of America. And if that doesn't fire you up, nothing will fire you up. I expect, secondly, that you will have fun. Something we don't talk about an awful lot, but I said to these folks, look, surely you're not doing this for the money. If you are, somebody lied to you, and I apologize for that. Surely you're doing this because it brings rewards far beyond money, and you get to represent the United States of America. If that's not fun, I don't know what is. So I expect, first, you'll work hard, and second, that you'll have a ton of fun doing it. Third, I told them, and I said, this is going to strike you a little strange, but I expect that you will keep a life, because it is from a breadth of life experience that comes the ability to exercise the enormous power you have in this institution wisely. You have the power for great good. The flip side is you have the power to do tremendous harm. The exercise of that power is guided best not by your smarts, but by your judgment. And that judgment, wherever it comes from, probably from your family, but it is cultivated by having the opportunity to breathe and to relax and to look at life from a slightly different perspective than every single moment at your desk. And while you're at it, that breadth of life will protect you physically because you're going to experience enormous stress in the work that you do for the Department of Justice. And while I'm at it, there are people in your lives called loved ones. I expect that you will love them, both because that's their title and so you're supposed to love them, but also because that's good for you. And that helps cultivate that judgment that I need you to have so badly. The fourth thing I told them, and this is the one I said is actually the most important to me, every single human being in this organization, I used to say, from the janitor to the attorney general, will be treated with the exact same amount of human dignity and respect. They are all God's creatures, and from a great distance or this close, there is absolutely no distinction that would justify you treating them differently. People's offices are important and entitled to respect, but the guy emptying your trash is no different and no less worthy of your respect than the person sitting in the top office. And fifth and last, I said, you are about to become, if you're just starting here, or if you work here already, you've already experienced an amazing gift. And it's a gift that you got when you joined this great organization, and one you may not have noticed until the first time you stood up and said, I represent the United States of America. Whether it was at a court proceeding or at a conference or at a cocktail party, the first time you said that, something really strange happened. Total strangers believed what came out of your mouth next. People who didn't know you at all, because you identified yourself as representing your country, believed what you said, and that's a gift. That gift, I would say to these folks, I think of as a reservoir of trust and credibility that you didn't earn, okay? That was earned for you by people who went before you and who stored up that reservoir of trust and credibility by making promises and keeping them, by defending this institution, by always confessing when they are in error and endeavoring to fix it, and by never forgetting that their obligation was to do justice more than it was to win. By doing that, those people built this gift for you and have left it for you by the sacrifices they made. Now, I used to say, especially to the new people, I don't mean to ruin your day, but with that gift comes a huge obligation. Your obligation is to protect it and to pass it to those who are going to come after you, who may never know you, may never know your name, but will know the gift when they stand up and say, I represent the United States of America, and they are believed. You will have done your job in protecting that gift. Now, after I explained the reservoir, I said, look, here's the problem. Reservoirs take forever to build and to fill. And one hole in the dam can drain the whole thing. One person's actions can destroy a gift that was built by generations. Here's how you protect it. You protect it with constant commitment to the truth, a recognition that the actions of one may affect the priceless gift that belongs to all of us, and a constant recognition that there is this reservoir that makes possible all the good that motivated you to join this institution. Now, that's what I would say to these people, new people starting, the veteran people who'd been around a while, especially for the new people so they knew what the bargain was they were getting into, and the veterans so they were reminded of why they had joined this great institution. Now, why do I tell you this when I'm trying to answer the question, why public service? I hope this gives you some sense of the excitement and honor that comes from service in a great institution. And I don't mean honor in the sense of awards and accolades. As Emerson wrote, human honor is but smoke which has no weight. Now, I struggled with Emerson's words when I was young and hungry for stuff to hang on my wall. It was only after I had more stuff than I had walls for, and I had had more than my share of human honor, that I realized he was absolutely right. Human honor is but smoke which has no weight. What has weight is not what other people notice or the medals they hang around your neck. What has weight is what you feel inside when you've worked a hard day to do your absolute best to do the right thing, when you have done everything you can do to make a difference in the lives of your fellow citizens or people you don't know around the world. I think it would be an awful thing to get to the end of this far too short life and realize that you have accumulated the smoke of success and nothing of real value. Public service offers rewards that can't be banked. They're not going to help you pay off your credit cards, but they are sure going to make you feel rich at the end of every long day. I said I wanted to offer you some very short reflections from my time in public service, and I, in thinking about it, chose two that are really broader life lessons, but that came to me most when I was in the government, especially the higher I got in the ranks of the government. And I don't think either one is going to be a shocker to you. The first is that people are flawed and often wrong. That's who we are. We make mistakes. It is the knowledge of that aspect of our nature that I think is critical. Because I knew this before, but the farther I got into government, the more it became clear to me that people are at their most dangerous when they are certain their cause is just and certain that their facts are right. Almost nothing can be known for certain or observed with perfect clarity. And here's where I get to indulge my geek chemistry major side. I recently read Walter Isaacson's great biography of Einstein. That's what led me to quote Einstein earlier. But one of the things that struck me in reading that as a former geek and marginally successful chemistry major is that Einstein was deeply unsettled by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And a reminder for all of you who may have forgotten Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. It's the idea that we cannot know the precise position of a particle because by attempting to measure it, we inevitably disturb it. So you can't really know. You can estimate the position of the most basic particles in nature. This drove Einstein crazy because it undercut his notion that the universe was essentially knowable, that we could, if we worked hard enough, determine positions and predict the movements of all nature's particles. But as Isaacson points out in the biography, later experiments proved that Heisenberg was right, or at least we think so. However unsettling that uncertainty is to a physicist, in public life, a healthy recognition of the limits of our ability to understand facts and to reason from them to sound decisions is a strength. But too often, in my experience, especially at the top of government, it is derided as a weakness, as somebody who is not solid or squishy or lacks conviction. And I think that's terribly wrong. Doubt is not weakness. Doubt is wisdom. I'm not talking about finger in the wind, I'm afraid to make a decision kind of doubt. One of the things about government that is most challenging the higher you get is that decisions have to be made, and they have to be made quickly, and often the most difficult have to be made the quickest, and on the most imperfect of information. And sometimes you're just right, and the other people are wrong. But the recognition that it could be the reverse is the mark of a wise decision maker. College taught me that in a huge way. Schools like those sponsoring this event teach that kind of thing every day. I didn't realize it at the time, or certainly appreciate it when I was in school, but it is an extraordinarily rare thing to find people who listen with their mind open to actually being convinced. More often, and especially in our nation's capital, what you find is folks listening only to use the time to figure out what the rebuttal is that they're going to deliver to what you're saying, and they're not looking to learn anything. What passes for listening is actually a polite pause in the action. It's a place where people often take a position rather than stating a belief. It's a place where people take sides and care mostly, unfortunately, sometimes whether their side wins, and never take the time to step back and say, am I still on the right side of this issue or this problem? It's a place where only those with a political death wish would pause and then say to their opponent, you know, I hadn't thought about it that way. You might be right. Of course, even with the best of intentions, real listening requires that we overcome our own neurochemistry. Brain scientists teach that humans are hardwired to do three things that get in the way of actual listening, right? And you know all these. The first thing is we tend to see, in the most basic physical sense among our neurons, we tend to see most clearly those facts that square with what we already believe. That's the first thing. The second thing is we have an enormously hard time with cognitive dissonance, with holding contradictory thoughts in our brain, and we tend to hide them on our back neurons. And third, we have a very hard time as humans changing first impressions. Those three things make up a troika of depressing biology facts that requires some serious work to overcome in people who really want to be listeners. Fortunately, our best teachers have insisted for a long time that we be better than our chemistry. They were, for me, and are today, the people who poke and prod, who demand that their students give a hard scrubbing to their assumptions, to their beliefs, to their conclusions. They are the people who demand that you actually listen to what the other person is saying. And they don't care where you come out on something, but they want to see the work. They want the work shown. They want to understand what your assumptions were, what consideration you gave to conflicting authorities, and whether you thought about the meaning of the words that you've chosen to express where you came out. They teach that it is vitally important to know just how sure you are of something. And great teachers also insist that we express our views clearly, which sounds like a modest goal, seemed like a modest goal when I was 18 or 19, but the more stuff I've read, the more I realize it is not. I never quite got over the fact that when I took in college, at a great liberal arts college, a class called Significant Books in Western Religion, the syllabus had 12 books drawn from a variety of traditions in Western religion. One of the 12 was Strunk and White's The Elements of Style. Now, I thought that was nutty, and the professor explained it's not, because all ideas are wasted that are not clearly expressed. And he used to say over and over again, this makes this one of the most significant books in Western religion, in fact, in all of life. And I've always kept one on my desk ever since. Now, it seemed weird to me at the time, like a lot of things adults did that no longer seem so weird to me, but he was absolutely right. The best schools, including those that are sponsoring this event, train a young mind to think broadly, to reason tightly, and never forget that somebody else might have the better of it. So shut up and listen to them. I can't tell you how valuable that lesson, those lessons from my teachers were for me in public service and will be for those of you who leave here to go into public service and also in life. So that's the first lesson that I draw from my experience in public service. The second is culture matters. So that's 2A. 2B, culture is shaped by watching. We modern humans have a tendency to sniff when somebody starts talking about culture like it's some kind of medieval mysticism, some sort of talisman, some superstition. But culture is real. Now, like air, it's invisible, but like air, it's also everywhere. Every grouping of people, every institution, every collection, every corner of our society, excuse me, and our world has a culture. Now, the best definition I have ever heard is culture is the way things are really done around here. Another definition I've heard, which is also good, is culture is the way things are really done around here no matter what they tell you in training. One easy example comes from a drive that I took last year with my family from Virginia, where I live, to northern New Jersey, where my folks live. And you can see right away what a nightmare it is to be one of my children. But we were driving along, and I was trying to explain culture to the kids. And this was not all that exciting for them, but I was really into it. And so here's the way I did it. I said, we lived for a decade in Richmond, Virginia. In Richmond, Virginia, and in the New York metropolitan area, they have the same driving rules. Same laws, same regulations, indistinguishable. If you drive in those two places, you would never know that. When we moved back to New York, when I became U.S. attorney, I had to teach my beloved bride, who's from Iowa and Virginia, not to use her turn signal on the highway, because it's a sign of weakness in the New York area. All of you know this. If you put on your signal, they're going to close up. So you say to her, don't signal, just move. They'll never know you're coming. Just go over there. In Richmond, Virginia, first time I was first there in 1993, I was at a traffic light, and there were two cars in front of me, and the light turned green. And there was an elderly woman in the first car, and she didn't notice that the light had turned green. So we sat there in total silence, and the light turned red. And then it turned green again, and she drove. That does not happen in the New York metropolitan area. Okay? Now, I was explaining this to my kids, and I said, do you know what that is? That's culture. That is the way things are really done around here. Driver's ed is the same in Richmond, Virginia, and in the New York metropolitan area, but the cultures are different. How did they get that way? Because generations of young drivers and new drivers from Iowa or Virginia have watched and learned and been shaped by it and conformed their conduct to the culture. How did you get to be who you are? I mean, as the father of five, one of the things I worry about all the time is, how do I get my children to be the way I want them to be? How did I get to be the way I am? How did you get to be the way you are? My guess is 10% of it is speeches. Right? You were given 5 points for this, 6 points for that. You were told never forget this, and you've forgotten it, but you were told things. 10%, maybe 20%. The rest of it was watching. You saw, not thousands, you saw millions of encounters. You went shopping with your mom and saw encounters there. People came to the door, and you watched what happened when someone came to the door. You watched coaches interact with other players. You watched millions and millions of these things, and it shaped who you were, without you even knowing it. The challenge especially of being a parent, is children are like these amazing sensors that my company makes. You put them on a satellite somewhere, and they drink in data all the time, 24/7. There's no turning them off. There is no time, especially with a child, when you can say, I'm turning you off. I'm a New York Football Giants fan, and so there's no time when I can say to one of my kids, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to turn you off, and I'm going to shout obscenities at the television for the next 2 hours, and I'm going to drink beer from a bottle, and you'll be off, and I'll turn you back on when that's over. There is no such thing. Those sensors are drinking in everything that's done and being shaped by it. Air, culture, goes stinky in ways you can't tell. Right? All of you have had this experience. There's a room, and somebody's in that room doing something stinky, cutting fish. And you step into the room from the outside. What is your reaction? Your reaction is, Lordy, what is that smell? And what is the reaction of the person who's been in the room doing the stinky stuff? Their reaction is, I don't smell anything. What are you talking about? Now, why is that? You know why it is. Because that air got stinky bit by bit by bit by bit. The challenge of culture being like air is that's how it goes bad. When I was U.S. attorney in New York, I oversaw the investigation and prosecution of executives at WorldCom who participated in $11 billion fraud, which I used to think was a big fraud. And in fact, I remember at the time saying, the biggest ever. Those days are over. But in the WorldCom case, one of the things that struck me most about it was when you stepped into WorldCom from the outside, it stunk to high heaven. But there were a lot of good people inside WorldCom who were actually involved in carrying out some of the instructions to make accounting changes after quarter end and move reserves accounts in absolutely criminal ways, who either didn't notice or didn't notice enough even to say, we don't do that. What had happened at WorldCom is the air had gone bad. And it had gone bad the way children are shaped, the way culture is shaped, bit by bit by bit. There was never a day at WorldCom where Bernie Ebbers, who was the CEO of WorldCom, there was never a day when he gathered people around a conference table and said, we're going to commit the largest financial fraud in American history. I'm thinking Tuesday, if that works for everybody. Because if that doesn't work, I'm traveling, so we'd have to do it the following week. That never happened. When I was first a federal prosecutor in New York, I worked on mafia cases. And I actually did cases where people sat around a table and said, we're going to whack Vinny. Wednesday looks like the best date for everybody. And when that didn't work, they did it the next Wednesday so it'd be easy to remember. Okay? True story. But that did not happen at WorldCom. Instead, what happened is emails and gestures and looks and shrugs and body language and thousands and thousands and thousands of things shaped a culture that was so stinky that when you stepped in from the outside, it was obvious. But that trapped a lot of good people in an environment where they simply didn't feel free to raise their hands. WorldCom, like Enron, had a remarkable set of compliance materials, a remarkable ethics manual and program. What's that great definition of culture? Culture is the way things are really done around here, no matter what they tell you in training. One of the things I struggled with as a career prosecutor was how to train junior prosecutors. And what I would talk to my supervisors about was both form and content. I'd say, look, the content is easy. Take something like your obligation to disclose exculpatory information. The bedrock of a fair criminal justice system, the government, which has a monopoly on information, must disclose what might help the defense. Else the system is rigged. Okay? The bedrock principle. And so I'd say to my supervisors, look, you got to tell them that, but you know what matters more than that? How you tell them. These baby prosecutors are sitting there drinking in everything you say, and if you give them that exculpatory information lecture with kind of a shrug that they read as, it's the kind of thing we got to do, but we're really not going to let some weasel defense lawyer tank a good case on us, but you have to be told about this. That's going to shape them in ways that we may never get another chance to shape them. If you instead say to them, look, listen to me. Okay? Someday this gun may be pointed at somebody you love. This is really, really important to make sure our system is fair. And your butt will be fired if you don't do this adequately. Focus them in ways beyond the mere content. Now, why do I tell you all this in the context of talking about a lesson from public service? Because one of the things that became clearer and clearer to me the higher I got in government institutions is that those institutions obviously have enormous power. Power that is steered by the rules, sure, by the written material, sure, but more by the culture of those institutions. And I saw repeatedly leaders who didn't appear to realize the significance of that and didn't appear to realize both the opportunity they had to shape culture for good and the danger that they might shape it in bad ways because the kids are always watching. I came across a lot of leaders who didn't appear to focus on the fact that the watching is more important than what they say. I think every leader in public service has to accept the burden of being constantly watched, but also understand the opportunity it provides them to shape a culture and to protect a culture. In a way, there's no bigger burden than inheriting a fundamentally healthy culture and understanding that you can't see it, you know it's good, and what you have to do is maniacally reinforce that positive culture and protect it. That's something I don't think in public service we talk and worry about enough. Throughout the life of our great country, I think America's best schools have turned out graduates who were hungry to be people of value, not just people of success. People who want to heal, to motivate, to lift, and to protect. We especially need those people now. There was a great legendary federal judge in New York named Learned Hand, and he gave a speech at the close of World War II, and he said something that struck me. It struck me that it's just as applicable today. He said this: "Our job will not end with the sound of the guns. We may not stop until we have done our part to fashion a world in which there shall be some share of fellowship, which shall be better than a den of thieves." So why public service? Because we need you. We need teachers, we need engineers, we need doctors and lawyers and soldiers and artists and diplomats and volunteers. We need those people and all the thousands of other folks who want to begin to serve or to continue to serve their community, their country, and their world. I think every single person can make a contribution. No matter how old you are or where you are in life, I hope very much that you can be inspired or still be inspired by the words of the great preacher John Wesley: to do all the good that you can, by all the means that you can, in all the ways that you can, in all the places that you can, at all the times you can, to all the people you can, as long as ever you can. And that's why public service. Thank you very much. All right, you're in charge. Questions? And you can ask anything. I'm from Washington, so I'm slippery. I will avoid anything I don't want to answer. It's always the first one. Yes, sir. You got to grab that mic so they get it.
I don't need a mic.
Well, they do for the...
All right.
So you and I are together in a digital record forever.
I don't think you... To me, you didn't bring up the issue of fairness. Let's look at our public education system. It really doesn't matter if you're a good teacher or a bad teacher. You're going to get paid. Now, what happens to the enterprising teacher? He goes into administration. So the kids lose a good teacher. So that system isn't so good. Now, you must have been fairly effective because now you work for Lockheed. I have a number of people who were effective with the state and got bought out by industry. I think that's another thing. How do you keep those 50 people you had?
How did I keep them when I was in the government? By making sure that they enjoyed their work, that they were doing something that they felt passionate about, and by constantly making sure that I, as their boss, understood how important their work was. And so a big part of my job was what I called my Queen of England role, which is just going and watching and seeing the work they did and thanking them for it. When I was Deputy Attorney General, the best part of my job was I would have my staff once a week give me a sheet of paper that had the names and direct dial telephone numbers of ordinary folks in the department, agents or lawyers who had done something, didn't get a lot of attention, and I would call them. And call them on the way to the White House for a meeting or something, just call them and tell them who I was and say, I read about it, I was just calling to thank you. Now, this caused a lot of hilarious phone conversations because still remember calling a guy from Oklahoma who recently resurfaced, who was from New Jersey, because we ended up chatting about it, and when I identified myself, he said, yeah, right, who is this? And I said, no, I'm Jim Comey, I'm the Deputy Attorney General. He goes, seriously, did Bob put you up to this? And it went on, and so finally I said to this guy, look, do me a favor. Hang up the phone. I'm going to sit right here. I'm not going to give you any advice. You go find the number for the Deputy Attorney General and call me. And then the long pause. And then he said, oh, and then said an obscenity. He said, oh, oh. And then we chatted, and I learned he was in New Jersey. So I think as a leader, your job is to make sure that the people that you understand how important it is for people to find meaning in their work and that you look for ways to reinforce that. Yeah. What else? Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned that it's almost harder to come into an organization that does have a good functioning working culture because you have the burden of responsibility of maintaining it. But if, as an employee, you come into an organization that's their culture is a little bit stinky, what do you do about it?
It's a great question. I guess it would depend upon what level you come in, or maybe it doesn't so much, is looking for ways within whatever group of people you can connect with or have responsibility for to try to shape the culture from sort of that position out. One of the interesting things about culture is people who are, which is nearly everyone, people who are more expert at this than I am, say it is impossible for humans to think of an us that extends more than 200 people. That your sense of us is actually, if you really drill into it, about 200 folks and in. So Lockheed Martin's 146,000 employees, but my Lockheed Martin is actually a much smaller group. So what matters is, in industry we talk all the time about tone at the top. That's great. But actually what matters far more, even than tone at the middle, is tone at units of 200 and smaller. So forget the generals, forget the colonels, forget the captains. What's actually most important is, what is the tone lieutenants and the sergeants are sending? And the reason I tell you this in response to what you said is, I think that's an opportunity when you realize that people's sense of us may be something I actually control if I'm the sergeant or I'm the lieutenant, and so I can shape it. And then maybe if I get promoted, I can shape it more broadly. But at least I can, because people will think of us in smaller groups, I can make more change than I might think before I came in. Yeah. Yes, sir. Right here on the aisle.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Would you comment, you're about on it, the difference between climate in the public sector, the private sector? Is it more difficult to shape the correct climate in the public sector than in the private sector?
That's a great question. It is, I believe, more challenging to shape a culture and lead in the public sector than the private sector. And here's why. And obviously I have wild biases because I learned to be a leader in the public sector, but I happen to think it's the best place to learn to be a leader because your ability to motivate, your toolbox to motivate, is much smaller than in the private sector. In the private sector, you have the ability to reward with significant financial incentives good performance. No matter who it is, staff person, more senior person, you have the ability to say, Mary, you did a fabulous job. We're going to give you a $50,000 bonus. You don't have that in the government. You also have the ability to be much tougher with people who are not performing. in the private sector, to cut salaries, even to fire people who are incompetent or misbehaving. Much, much harder in the government. In the government, you have to learn to motivate positively, because your ability to motivate negatively is almost non-existent. I know the federal government better than other governments, but it's very, very hard to get to move someone who's not performing, and there's no ability to reward with significant dough or to hurt those who are not doing their job. So what you have to learn to do is convince people that we have a mission that you all should care about, that I will work as hard as I'm asking anybody to work, and that I need you to follow me. And as a leader in the government, you have to learn to sort of run forward and hope everyone's following you, kind of thing. In the government, I mean, out of the government, sometimes there's an ability, it's an ugly comparison, but I compare it to sort of the American fighting force versus, say, the old Soviet fighting force. The guns are behind you in the Soviet fighting force. In the American fighting force, I'm following a brave lieutenant who I love, and I see my men, we all care together, so we rush this hill. In the Soviet fighting force, perhaps they're taking the hill because they're afraid of getting shot if they go backwards. In the government, you have to learn to motivate positively, to sell the mission. And I don't envy anybody who comes into any large government institution saying, we are going to change the way this is, without realizing that the people there, if they don't believe in what you're doing, how long will he be here? Got another couple of years. All right, well, I'll take it easy for the next couple of years. You're only changing that mission if you can sell it to the folks who are there that it's a mission they ought to follow. And that's both hard and a great training opportunity. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Hi. I chose a career public service after I graduated from Dickinson in law school. So I've been with the Environmental Protection Agency for 24 years. And we've heard a lot today about the advantages of public service and disadvantages. I wanted to, if you could address one of the disadvantages, besides the student debt loans we were talking about before, was sometimes when you see things fundamentally wrong and you see some serious principles at risk, you know, in your own career, you have the well-documented instance where you went to the hospital room and with the White House counsel, and I know I see it in my own career at EPA, you know, in the past administrations. A neighbor of mine back in D.C., Justice Department lawyer Tom Tam, he obviously felt he was in that similar situation. And I was wondering if you could address some of the young people about, you know, that disadvantage and what advice you would have for them as they go into a career in public service when they feel themselves in a tough situation like that.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that it's all that different in any large institution, public or private, because you could be at a big company and find yourselves in situations just as difficult as any you might encounter in the government. The stakes tend not to be as high as they often are in the government, but similar. I mean, my advice is not complicated. It's just do the right thing. Life is really short and way too short to ever be in a situation where you are not comfortable that the right thing is being done. Now, what scares people sometimes is, I can understand it, is you don't want to lose your job and you have people to support. But, man, you don't want to lose who you are, too. So yeah, that's my best advice. Now, easier said than done, frankly, but I think you will, you know, until you find yourself in a situation like that, you maybe will underestimate your ability to stand up when you find yourself facing a situation where you don't think the right thing is being done. But, again, the reason I hesitate to say this is I mentioned WorldCom. There was a case, a woman in WorldCom who was in accounting, and I remember her name, which I'm not going to say, but she got an order that came rolling down the hill to Clinton, Mississippi, where her office was, to make after quarter close adjustments in the books. Clearly wrong. And she did it, even though she knew it was wrong. And she said when the FBI interviewed her, look, I knew this was wrong, but I support our family. This is the best job in Clinton, Mississippi. If I said no, I'd be fired. And you know, one of the hardest decisions I made in government was I insisted she plead guilty because I thought I was duty-bound as a public prosecutor to try and send a message that is not acceptable. And you may find yourself trapped in a situation like that, and hopefully you'll do the right thing because it's the right thing. But if I can help by being a scary prosecutor, I will. But, you know, I had tremendous sympathy for her and worked very hard to make sure that she got a probationary sentence. But, you know, the only thing I would go into it understanding that it could happen to you at some point and think through what you're going to do. How are you going to get out of that organization? And if you're in a place where if something broke bad and you wouldn't be able to leave, you should find something else to do because it could happen to you. Sort of like all of us reminding to figure out where the exits are on a plane, for heaven's sakes. We see incidents recently that remind us why we should take our headphones off and figure out where the exits are. I think when you begin a career, you should assess the institution and say, all right, if it ever got ugly, what am I going to do? So anyway, sorry to run on about that one. What else? Yes, sir.
I wonder if there were some inherent contradictions in some of your advice and what you explained about your experience. You said how you worked them like dogs every waking hour, and then during in your sort of rules, you said have balance, have a life, have loved ones. How can you have loved ones that you actually spend time with if you're working 7 days a week, every waking hour? And I understand it was an exaggeration because I work in D.C. and I actually share office space with folks, a lot of folks who were in the public sector, worked very, very hard for not a whole lot, and then left and are now in the private sector, earning a lot more money, working a lot less hard, fewer hours, and it's a much more relaxed kind of a life where they can go home and see their families and spend time and take vacations and all that. So how can you have that balance in the public sector that you want and is important, and yet still do your mission and still be committed to the cause?
No, it's a great point. It's a fair point, too. The what I worried about, especially when I was U.S. Attorney in New York, is I knew people were going to work like crazy. Because when you have a job that you love, doing good, it can consume you. Because there's always somebody else to help. There's always something else to work on, a bad guy to chase. And so the reason I always included the loved ones part of the speech is because I knew how hard they were going to work. And I said I expected them to work hard. Maybe I shouldn't have done that, but it wasn't changing behavior, I don't think, too much. What I was trying to do was change the behavior by saying, make sure you find time to look after those people because you will be consumed. I don't have a great answer for that. There is a risk that when people are doing something they love, that it will chew up their private life because they won't spend enough time. I think it is the job of the supervisor to say, it's okay to have time in your life for someone. I didn't give you the full speech, but I used to say to these young folks, look, there is no feeling in the world like a 2-year-old running across the floor to you when you come home. I've experienced it more than most people, and it is an amazing thing. And I'd say to men and women, I'd say, do not miss that. Do not miss that. You're hearing that from the U.S. attorney. Go home, experience that, put that child to bed, and then start working again. And I said that because I knew they would, but I want to encourage some flexibility. I mean, one of the things we spend a lot of time in our company worrying about is our young people. Somebody just explained it to me, a 25-year-old engineer. He said, you old people, my God, tend to think about work-life balance as a zone of work and a zone of life. And you try to make sure that you have the amounts you want. We don't think of it that way. We actually think of it as work-life integration. And we want the tools, the technology especially, to be able to work when we want, live when we want. So I summarized it for the guy. I said, so basically you're saying you don't mind working all the time, you just want slices of life inserted? And he laughed and he said, you know what I want to be able to do? I want to be able to go home, play with my kids, open my laptop, work, watch TV for a while, go on, all these devices that I don't understand too well, the Web 2.0 devices, and I want to be able to work whenever I want. I want it to be okay with you if I work at 2 in the morning, and I sleep and come into work at 11. I want you not to care when I work so long as I get it done. And think about a company of rocket scientists and people who make airplanes. That is a foreign culture for us. But it struck me, I hope that's not destructive for folks, that integration of work and life. But anyhow, to come back where I started, I think it's the job of a boss to make sure that you tell people, I value, if you tell me you're taking this afternoon off to go to your daughter's play, I value that. I care about that. That's not the whole answer, because ultimately it's the people deciding that they want to carve out that time. I'll tell you one thing that really struck me. When I left the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan and went to a big law firm in Virginia, because there was a hiring freeze in the government. When I moved to Richmond, I couldn't get in. I went to a big law firm. They made me a partner and paid me a lot of money, and I didn't work as hard. as I did at the government, I was miserable. Because I, as corny as it sounds, I had a job I liked, but not a job I loved anymore. And I really missed having a job with moral content. And I miss it sometimes too. I'm lucky enough that the work I do is so closely related to the government that a lot of it feels the same. But even now, the proportions of compensation and responsibility in my life compared to my last job are precisely reversed. Right? I felt like I had the whole world on my shoulders and got paid nothing last time. Here, in the private sector, I get paid a lot of money and don't have those responsibilities. But what I'm missing is that moral content, that opportunity to be part of the life of my country in a way that I just can't where I am now. What else? Yes, sir.
There's a third world. You and I at a lower level worked for the government, got paid a pittance compared with what you can earn outside. Some of us have gone out into the NGO world where you have all the passion, you're working for good, you're working with wonderful people to accomplish wonderful things, and there's not a damn dime to do it on. American foundations are walking away from this work. People in the school like this know what I'm talking about. Tremendous work. And people want you to produce a product out of human relationships so that they can measure it and justify giving you money. So I don't know what you have to say about the third world that you've not lived in, but you share the passion.
Yeah. And when I say public service, I mean that as well. I'm not just talking about working for a government institution.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have anything useful to say. I hear what you're saying.
Thanks for coming, Mr. Comey. I was wondering how you would respond to a much bleaker view of politics that, of course, there's a long tradition of looking at politics almost in a diametrically opposed view than the one that you have. And I'm referring to a Machiavellian view of politics, or Michael Walzer, who is a political philosopher from Princeton, has the notion that dirty hands in politics. You can't keep your hands absolutely crystal clean. Because of the nature of politics, or the Huey Long tradition and the notion you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. And I was just asking, what do you think, how do you contrast your position to that alternative view of politics?
Yeah, I guess I don't know the academic work enough, but my reaction is that it almost seems to assume that there's a pure sphere of human affairs. And the challenge for me is I've been a criminal prosecutor most of my life. So I have a fairly dark view of what people are capable of. And people are flawed, as I said. And I think there are mean, sneaky, weaselly people, obviously not at Dickinson or Maine, but in all walks of human life. And, corporate America has them. All human organizations have them. I mean, people are a mix. And what I liked best about my time in government service was maybe that when I was farther away from the pure political. One of the things I loved about being, for example, at a U.S. attorney's office was there just wasn't a sense of, first of all, of elective politics. I mean, it just wasn't something you considered or talked about. But there's also much less a sense of sort of office politics. There was this passion about the mission that's hard to describe from the outside. The challenge for me is I kept getting promoted until I was eventually to the point where I have to be kicked out. But the higher I got, the closer I got to kind of the political world, the less satisfying some of the public service became, where I had to spend much more time worrying about some of the more Machiavellian challenges than you did farther down in the trenches. But people often ask me, by the way, about the Department of Justice, whether I think somehow that the Attorney General ought to be separately selected or not appointed by a president. And the answer, because of the influence of the evil world of politics, my answer is absolutely not. That the president should be able to pick an Attorney General to carry out that president's criminal justice policies and priorities, civil rights policies and priorities, and that it is the job of the Attorney General and the deputy to stand in this weird place. And you have to bear with me while I explain what a weird place it is. I go to the beach in North Carolina with my kids, and between some of the barrier islands in a couple of spots, there's what looks like open water, but it's actually kind of a sandbar just below the water. And so you have this weird phenomenon where the water's coming out of the sand and from the ocean, and actually waves are breaking where there doesn't appear to be any land. It's the sandbar hidden underneath. I think that's the spot where the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General stand. They are facing the political world out towards the ocean, and they have to take direction from the people's elected representative, the President of the United States, for certain policy priorities. But behind them stands an institution that has to be apolitical for a host of reasons, including practical. If agents and prosecutors are seen as Democrats or Republicans or Greens or whatever, they can't get the job done. They can't rise before a jury and say, I represent the United States, and be believed, because suddenly they're no longer an other in American life. They are of this group or that group or these people I don't like so much. To get its work done, to protect civil rights, housing discrimination, to fight predators, all the things that the department does, it has to be an other in American life. And so the Attorney General and the deputy have to stand there knowing that they somehow have to be where that weird water collision is between their apolitical organization and the political sea and carry it out. And the best way to do it, I think, is always to err on the side of doing things that are going to make it easier for those men and women rising, trying to win those cases that make possible all the good the department accomplishes, and make those kind of things presumptively good. Anything that's going to make it harder, presumptively bad. It's never going to be perfect, but I very much believe that the Attorney General should be an appointed member of the cabinet who can't ever forget that he or she presides over an institution that's unlike any other in American life and has to stand apart. So that's the way I think about dealing with some of the weaselness. Yeah.
Thank you very much for this really enlightening talk. And this question really applies to public servants who have reached a higher level, such as you or Ambassador Burns. How do you balance the media perception of how you are performing and doing your job, and then how you deal with the internal matters, how your people who are working for you perceive you because they read the Washington Post that day? So how do you balance that too? Because I think that's another area that frequently we have not talked a lot about, is that you have responsibilities within the government, but then there are other responsibilities that show up later on, which is cultivated by the media. So how do you see the role of media impacting who you are and some of those ideals that you mentioned?
That's a great question. It's kind of a weird one for me, because I'm going to tell you something that I absolutely believe. My media profile, I think I come across as a better guy than I really am. I've tried to explain it, but I'm a good guy. I'm not a great guy. And so you just can't worry about that. People are going to write what they're going to write on either side. But I'll tell you one thing about the media that I never realized until I got to higher positions of government is what an incredibly important role the media plays in government decision-making in ways that may not be obvious from the outside. When you're making a hard decision in the government, the media is always in the room, because you assume it's going to be leaked at some point, or it'll come out at some point. And so we have to make this decision thinking about, what will folks think about it? How will it look on the front page of the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times? And that's not a bad thing, because I used to try to tell law students especially, look, there's a huge difference between intelligence and judgment. Intelligence is the ability to figure out a problem, to solve a riddle, to nail a set of facts. That's intelligence. Judgment is something different and much rarer. Judgment is the ability to take those facts and walk around them and see how others might see them, how they might be viewed by a finder of fact, by a congressional committee, by how they might be seen by the media. How will they be seen 5 years from now? How might they be seen in light of other things? To totally walk around. That rare ability, judgment, is aided immeasurably by the sort of metaphorical presence of the media in the room when you're making the decision, because it forces you to say, how will this look What will people think? What will be said? And their presence drags you around those facts and forces you to think about them. So the media was constantly in our lives, and much more than I ever expected before I got to higher levels in government. I mean, just getting the clips every morning, we'd get these, I'm sure the ambassador did as well, you'd get these things organized by departments. So you'd obviously read about your department first, and just see what the media is saying about you. And that brought them more and more into the room, and I think was a force for good. Now, I'm against leaks. It's an odd thing to say, especially of classified information, but the presence of that media was very, very valuable. You're going to sing a song now? Right.
Would you please join me once again in thanking Mr. Comey for coming? The next section of our conference will be a panel discussion entitled The Pros and Cons of Public Service. So, that discussion will be held in this room, the Stern Great Room, at 3 p.m.